Let's go now to New Mexico and talk with Dr. Rick Strassman. Dr. Strassman has a rather interesting background. He holds degrees from Stanford University and the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University. He went to University of California Davis Medical School in Sacramento. He spent 10 years as a tenured professor at the University of New Mexico, performing clinical research, investigating the function of the pineal hormone melatonin, which you're probably familiar with. He began this first U.S. government-approved and funded clinical research with psychedelic drugs in over 20 years. And he's published 30 peer-reviewed scientific papers, serves as a reviewer for several psychiatric research journals. He's been a consultant to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, National Institute on Drug Abuse, Veterans Administration Hospitals, on and on and on and on. He currently practices psychiatry in Taos, New Mexico, and is an associate clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. Dr. Rick Strassman, welcome to Coast AM. I normally don't go into all that great depth and detail about someone's background, but, you know, people don't believe that a scientist really would spend all this time studying a psychedelic DMT. How did you get involved in this?
Well, I would like, you know, first of all, to thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome.
And thank your listeners for tuning in. Yeah, and that was quite an introduction. That was one of the best introductions I think I've had to my book.
Well, you know, let me get right to something that really, there's something disturbs me in your book, very much so.
It's disturbing information, really.
Well, that's true. It is disturbing information, and I'm desperately trying to find where you say this in your book, but I'll paraphrase it because I can't find it right now. But you say the reason you left this research is because so many of the people that you were studying, the volunteers, were seeing these otherworldly beings, and you didn't know how to handle it. And that's the reason you left it. Is that true? You stand by your statement?
It was a complicated confluence of reasons that I left, but I think it's safe to say it just got too strange. It just got beyond anything I could really comfortably sort of relate to after a while. It was a very trying time, but when we began the research, spirits were high. We were all quite exhilarated that we had finally gotten this research off the ground. But as time went on, it was feeling increasingly as if I had opened Pandora's box, that I had just had a tiger by the tail. I was in over my head. All those expressions, describe how I started to feel after doing DMT research for 4 or 5 years.
Dr. Strassman, I don't understand why this work has not received wider publicity, why other people haven't picked up on your research. I mean, we are thirsty, we are parched, trying to understand what ETs are all about, what near-death experiences are all about. Your work comes closest to explaining it of anything that I have seen. And I've been in this business for, at least 30 years. You know, it's the first time I've said, hey, science has caught up with the rest of the world. I know that, you know, ayahuasca is the same thing, and that the the people in Latin America, the shamans have been using it for years and for these out-of-body experiences and all the rest of it. But to get right down to it, to be able to measure it, to do double-blind studies and to find, I mean, what's going on here, Rick? Why hasn't somebody picked it up? I mean, academia, are they still afraid of this?
Well, I think in terms of maybe the mainstream media, why they haven't picked it up more is because of the still negative sort of reactions that people feel when they hear the expression psychedelic drugs. And A number of people actually have not responded to my request to let me be interviewed on their show. And I think the point I try and make to them, which is probably the one that's just not getting through, is that it's not a book about drugs. It's not a book about, you know, psychedelic drugs, Tim Leary. It's about a naturally occurring compound that the brain makes and the lung makes and the blood makes and perhaps the pineal gland makes. It's a story about that compound rather than necessarily drugs. But the fact, the fact of DMT being a drug, it is used on the streets. It is used recreationally. It just has a very negative type of association attached to it. And for people to really get past the drug aspect, I think would really, as you're saying, open up a lot of, just a lot of explanatory doors that just aren't open right now.
You say that the pineal gland, is that how you pronounce it, pineal?
Pineal, yeah.
Okay. The pineal gland, which, by the way, is the only gland in the brain that doesn't come in pairs, which is sort of interesting. And you claim that this DMT, which is manufactured normally in the body,
correct,
is one of the very few compounds or chemicals that goes beyond the blood-brain barrier. The brain has a barrier that keeps most things out, thank God. But this DMT goes right through. And you claim that the brain seems to hunger for this DMT.
Yeah, it's a very interesting fact. Well, I could give you some background about DMT itself. It stands for dimethyltryptamine. It's sort of a cousin of serotonin, also chemically very similar to the pineal hormone melatonin. It was first made in a lab in Manitoba, maybe 70 years ago or so. And it was just made to demonstrate that a drug with that molecular structure could be made. So nobody ever took it. And then DMT was discovered in psychedelic snuffs from the Amazon in the late 1940s, early 1950s. And then it was discovered that if you injected DMT, it was quite a powerful psychoactive drug. Then a few years after that, in the early 60s...
Just let me interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
If you swallow it, it has not the same effect at all. Mm-hmm. It has to be injected, right?
It's true. It needs to be injected or smoked. Or swallowed if it's combined with a chemical that inhibits its breakdown in the stomach. Otherwise, if you swallow DMT, for example, in that Amazonian brew that you mentioned called ayahuasca, if you just swallow pure DMT without a chemical that's found in ayahuasca that prevents its breakdown in the stomach, then otherwise, though, if you swallow DMT, it is inactive. It's broken down quite quickly.
Okay, but what you did was you injected it. And there were some startling results.
It was really sort of way beyond what we were expecting. And I was expecting quite a bit, even though I couched the project in pretty traditional psychopharmacology terms. But despite the rather bland presentation that the research assumed, I was still expecting near-death experiences, mystical experiences, deep psychotherapeutic healing experiences. But people had those experiences, but a lot more, as you were saying earlier. A fair number, at least a half of the volunteers, there were 62 volunteers or something in our study, and at least one half of those volunteers under the influence of a high dose of DMT came back from the experience and said that they had met intelligences, them out there, and the nature, the qualities, the characteristics of them. Kind of varied between person to person, but there are a lot of similarities, and just the sheer number of reports of some contact with an intelligent entity was probably the most startling result that we determined.
Okay, so we'll get into, in the next half hour, we'll get into some of these individual stories. But what is important here is that somehow people are seeing beings, otherworldly beings. And it's not like, you know, some people are seeing one kind of being and the next person sees another kind of being, but many of them who don't even, these people don't know each other.
Correct.
They're seeing the same beings. Mm-hmm. Now, not all. I mean, there are clowns, there are bugs, there are serpentines, there are grays, there are, you know, a whole variety, but many of these people are seeing the same beings. And many of these people are being taken aboard craft. Now, you point out in your book that a lot of these people didn't know anything about abductions when they went into this thing.
That's true, actually. My studies took place in the early and mid-1990s. And even at that point, people were not that current. Well, most people in the study were not familiar with Terrence McKenna's work either. And so I just couldn't chalk it up to people having the sorts of experiences that they were hoping for, because...
In other words, they didn't have a preconceived idea of meeting these otherworldly characters.
No, absolutely not. They were surprised, as I was.
Hmm. All right, well, Rick, I haven't got time now to go into all these various stories. When we do come back, I want to be very specific about what these people were seeing and how they saw it. And I've been meaning for a long time to talk to somebody about what happened to the death of my son, or what happened when he died. A very strange story that may relate to DMT, and maybe you can help me understand it better. So we are talking with Dr. Rick Strassman. His book is DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And we have a lot of shocking material to go through. Sitting in for George Nouri, I am Hilly Rose.
Would you pay 15 cents to hear this show in its entirety? That's the daily charge for Streamlink. Sign up at www.coasttocoastam.com.
Rick, I got an email today. they posted on the website my email, and emails have been pouring in. But I got an email from one fella from Texas, and he said, I take that DMT stuff, and I didn't see any ETs. You want to address that issue?
Yeah. I think some people just aren't sensitive to normal amounts of DMT. I think it's a hardwiring phenomenon. The brain, in a certain number of people, just does not seem to react to DMT the way most of us do. It could be if you gave those people enough DMT, they would have the same sort of experience that others do at lower doses. But in our study, we studied 60 people, and I think three of them had barely perceptible effects of a dose of DMT that for the vast majority of people was the most powerful psychedelic experience of their entire lives.
You mean they had no effect at all, or very little effect?
In three of our 60 people, they didn't have any effect at all. Well, maybe not exactly no effect. One person didn't even know we had finished giving him the injection. He turned to us and said, "Are you done yet?" And I looked at the syringe and I looked to make sure the IV was in his arm. But it all went in, and he barely, it had no effect whatsoever.
Okay, let's describe what we can just quickly. I don't want to get too technical here. What happened is people got four doses, and you started with a small dose and then increased it. Is that right?
When people got involved with the study, I started everybody off on a small dose to just kind of get them used to being in the hospital and getting a drug. And then once they got through the low dose, if they wanted to continue, then we gave them a high dose. And then after that, at least for the first study, they came in a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled manner, which means that the amount of DMT they were getting that neither I knew nor they knew. There were small doses there, big doses, and a couple of medium doses.
And do this lifting of the veil, as it were, to see a parallel universe or ETs, which may be surrounding us even now, all around, we don't see them. We don't see them because, for some reason, that veil is put there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people don't really understand. Even doctors sometimes don't stop to think. We know how the body works. We don't know why it works a certain way. There are many things that we just plain don't understand. Now, you know, what could be happening here, as I pointed out earlier, is it could just be that people are dreaming. But isn't it strange? I mean, maybe this DMT makes them dream. But isn't it strange that these people who are not related seem to dream the same dream, seem to see the same people? Clowns, by the way, seem to be very big in people. Not and many of them malevolent clowns. Is that right?
Well, that's true. Yeah, I think what you were just talking about, though, is quite interesting. The whole issue of how come we don't see these things more often, and also the issue of DMT and dreams. A few minutes ago, the issue of the brain craving DMT came up, and it's one of the very few compounds that the brain actually expends energy in order to allow it to cross the blood-brain barrier. There's very few chemicals that the brain will actually do that to. For example, sugar, which is the brain's fuel, is actively transported. But strangely enough, it seems as if DMT is actively transported, which makes you think that in some way the brain requires DMT for optimal functioning. And so even though people have always talked about everybody is always living in a dream, the so-called consensual reality is just a dream, as opposed to just the dreams we have at night. One of the things that I included as a footnote, actually, but didn't pursue much in the original book, is the question of, well, if the brain seems to need DMT, and DMT is a powerful hallucinogen, it gives you almost a mechanism of action, a way of explaining how people have over the centuries and the millennia sometimes referred to this everyday reality as a hallucination or a dream. And everybody is experiencing that at the same time, which is a very peculiar phenomenon.
In other words, the day-to-day life that we live is the dream.
It could be. It could be. If the brain requires DMT, I mean, makes you wonder why in the world the brain would want or... It seems as if DMT is necessary for brain function.
What bothers me about many of these visualizations is they're malevolent. There's an underlying malevolency. We have a lot of people who, one guy was sexually, violently attacked by crocodiles.
I know, that was a very scary day for everybody.
In what way?
Well, it was such a horrible experience, and it just seemed like almost a manifestation of some kind of evil just descended on this poor, helpless man. And even though it was horrifying, he pulled through and did fine with a little support. but I mean, I don't mean to sound at all glib, but it was a horrifying experience for him. And I must admit, at that point, paused a bit and thought to myself, is it worth doing this sort of research if people are going to have that kind of an experience?
There are so many experiences here that I could talk about. Four distinct beings looked down on me like I was on an operating table. I opened my eyes. And that's the point I wanted to make. For many of these people, they would close their eyes. But when they opened their eyes, those beings were still there.
Mm-hmm. It was almost like a bleed-through, like a trans-world or trans-universe or trans-dimensional bleed-through almost. Yeah, and with eyes closed or eyes open, they saw pretty much the same thing on a large dose of DMT.
Wow. One that plays through frequently is bugs.
Yeah, some people saw insects. Some people saw ants, bees, praying mantises. Some people saw sort of space-type people like androids, sort of Star Trek, Star Wars types. And, you know, it's the most common criticism I get about talking about the entities, and especially about the space part or the ultra technical part, is that my volunteers were just very intoxicated and were under the influence of the environment in which the research was taking place. It was a pretty clinical, sterile sort of research unit in a university hospital. But you know, it just didn't feel that way to the volunteers. I think also the fact that people taking ayahuasca in the Amazon, some of the Native Americans down there, experience ultra-technological hallucinations, visions, experiences under the influence of ayahuasca. And ayahuasca, as you know, contains DMT. So I think that...
Let me understand what you just said. Are you saying that the... people in Latin America who use ayahuasca, which is the same thing, how do they use it, by the way? They don't inject it. Do they chew it or swallow it or what? Smoke it?
Well, in terms of ayahuasca, that's a drink.
It's a drink?
It's a drink.
But then you say that doesn't affect the body the same way.
Well, that's true. And for some reason, some very interesting psychopharmacology took place in the Amazon 20,000 years ago. Because the natives stumbled upon, or they found, or the plant told them, that to mix two different plants allowed the DMT to become orally active. So there's one plant that contains DMT, and that's brewed with a second plant, which contains something that allows the DMT to stay active. And so these pre-industrial or non-industrial cultures, people within them who take ayahuasca also experience spaceships and technological interventions. But I think that the issue of the form these entities take, that seems cultural. And so I think that's not so hard to explain, or it's not worth objecting to. But the fact that there has to be something clothed, it seems like these entities are clothed in forms that we are familiar with. It also may be that enough people have the experience in some far distant place that others who are taking it have the same experience. For example, some people without any experience with ayahuasca who will take it in a European country, in an American country, experience visions of jaguars and anacondas and vines and those kinds of things.
Well, that would make me believe, if it's cultural, that it's a dream. There's no veil being lifted here. It's just a dream. Because otherwise the people in Latin America would see exactly the same insectoids that the people in room 531 of the hospital saw?
Mm-hmm. Well, a dream. Well, at first, I really thought to myself anyway, and just at grasping at straws, interpreted these experiences as dreams. So I said, oh, that sounds like a very interesting dream. And it was a sort of an unnervingly common experience. The volunteers would just look at me right in the eye and say, this was not a dream. This was real. This is more real than reality. It's more real than a dream. They seem to be able to observe and judge, engage, and interact in a way that was quite qualitatively different than a dream.
I know one of your volunteers said, I couldn't have made this up if I wanted to.
I know. There were a lot of elements that just didn't seem like a dream, and I discarded that explanation for most of people's entity contact experiences.
Rick, let me ask you this question, as I'm sure asked of you all the time. You did this five-year research program. You did it on OPM, other people's money.
Other people's money.
And
right.
Much of it was United States government money or taxpayers' dollars.
Right.
What did we buy for that?
What did we buy? Well, speaking of the funding aspect, the first grant I received for the DMT research was from the Scottish Rite Foundation, which is a branch of the Masons. So they were the first people actually to invest in the research. After we finished that study up, I got some money from the federal government, and we can talk about that maybe.
All right, we'll talk about that in the next segment. We'll do about a half hour here more, and we'll talk about the pharmacology of it all. And there are just a lot of other questions I want to ask you. And then I'll open the phone lines about 30 minutes into the next half hour. So you stay right there, please. A lot of very fascinating stuff to come as we continue our conversations with Dr. Rick Strassman. Sitting in for George Nuri. Hope he's listening, and I hope he's got the creeps from all this. Nah, he understands too well. Okay, I am Hilly Rose.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505.
Returning now to New Mexico and Dr. Rick Strassman. Rick, you do address near-death experiences in your book. You want to just talk a little bit about that and how many of your people, or I was going to say how many people had them, and what can you explain about a near-death experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the descriptions of near-death experiences, they sound quite a bit like a big psychedelic trip, as it were. The separation of consciousness from the body, the extreme emotional responses, either ecstasy or terror.
People talk about a big white light.
People talk about a big white light. They talk about encountering beings, either their relatives or angels or something similar. And one of my theories before I began with the DMT studies was that at the time of death, there might be a surge in production of DMT, and such a change in brain chemistry might either mediate or underlie or cause or somehow be associated with the near-death experience.
That's what you thought.
That's what I thought, and to see if that hypothesis was supported by experimental data, The injection of a large dose of DMT, which would be expected to produce levels in the brain that were quite high, similar to ones which might occur naturally under stress. In our volunteers, people given a big dose of DMT reported many experiences that have been described in the near-death one.
They thought they were going to die.
Well, most people in the study, I kind of warned them actually before their first big dose. I would say to them, you may think you've died. And so I basically prepared people, which, you know, some people might think, well, I was suggesting things to them. But I think in the nature of informed consent, you really have to tell people what's going to happen. And a lot of people I spoke to who had done smoke DMT on the street or in the field or in their homes, a lot of people who reported to me before I began the study what sort of things to expect in the research I was doing.
So in a sense, Rick, you gave them a suggestion.
Well,
and they followed through.
I don't know. People that smoke DMT at home also experience the feeling of feeling near death or that they have died. And those people aren't necessarily told that that's going to happen, but it seemed such a common experience in the people I had spoken with, my informants, before beginning the research, that I thought it only fair to tell people that they might fear that they have died.
Well, now, I have talked to people who did not take DMT, but who were perhaps operated on, and said that during the operation, like, I don't know what chemicals they ingested in their body, you know, given them by the anesthetist, but they talked about having a near-death experience during the operation.
That's true. And I think probably the stress of being under any life-threatening circumstances, car accident, being operated on under general anesthesia, and at the actual time of death, I think there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, at least, to really support looking into whether DMT is increased at these times. It could reliably mediate those sort of experiences that are so interesting for us, and if we could study them experimentally, I think we would gain quite a bit.
All right, that raises a whole subject I'll get into with you in just a second, but I do want to ask you, I don't recall anywhere in your book that anybody had what we would term a religious experience. Nobody saw Buddha, nobody saw the Virgin Mary, nobody saw God as we envision what God is. I mean, who knows? But I don't recall there was anything in your book about that.
Well, I think it's true that many of our volunteers experienced a lot of the things that people also undergo in a spontaneous mystical experience. I think that the mystical experience and the near-death experience share quite a bit, and those experiences share quite a bit with the abduction experience at times. But for sure, it has a lot to do with a high dose DMT experience. But one gal in particular I'm thinking of experienced or sort of saw a laughing Buddha in her vision, in her trance, in her state. Other people had mystical experiences. They were absorbed by the white light. They went through a tunnel and heard angels singing on either side of them. They were being tempted by more demonic forces at the same time. So I think it's not quite safe to say there are no mystical experiences, but the experiences sort of overshot mystical experiences. I mean, I was hoping, as part of my maybe covert research agenda, was to see if giving DMT would elicit mystical experiences.
Well, if indeed DMT lifts the veil, and what we're seeing is a parallel universe, or another universe, or people from elsewhere, other dimensions, then I guess one wouldn't expect to see the Virgin Mary, because the Virgin Mary was human.
Well,
I mean, it's
I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, if the Virgin Mary was human, she certainly still is being experienced by a lot of people after her death.
That's right. And that's sort of what I want to get to, is you go to Lourdes, or you go to, you know, you read in the paper all the time about people who see this vision of the Virgin Mary on a glass of some kind. None of them have taken DMT.
No, but it could be in that state of exhilaration, the stress of the trip. Maybe they haven't eaten or slept for days. It's possible to theorize that the stress would increase natural levels of DMT.
All right, so here again, people are seeing what they have a predisposition to see.
Yeah.
That would give us, you know, the fact that we got dreams we're dealing with.
Well, I'm not sure. I think it's the subjective difference that seems to exist between dreams and what happens in something like Lourdes or something that happened in our hospital room. And it may happen to a smaller extent in dreams. That's not to say that dreams and these more intense experiences aren't on the same spectrum of experiences.
Before we get lost in another topic, I just wanted to get back to what people were seeing. And many people saw elves. You know, we hear about the Irish folks and the little people. I don't know whether that's in the same category, but elves and clowns seem to come up all the time. I wonder why.
Yeah, I don't know why. I could theorize. And one of the theories I've been sort of toying with is that these entities are, in a way, without any shape or without any form. They're just influences, sort of divine influences, as it were, spiritual influences, which are around us at all times and affect us. And just as a result of our culture, they get kind of clothed in forms that we can relate to.
I don't want to give the impression that DMT has no ill effects. I mean, it has some good effects for a number of people. They don't fear death the way they used to fear it before they took the DMT. They've changed their lives in a lot of ways. But there are people who are so stressed they have formed DMT support groups.
Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting outcome of the study, is about halfway through, when more and more people were having these entity experiences. It was unnerving. At the time, I had a hard time understanding it and explaining it in a way that made them comfortable. And so, sort of spontaneously, a group of the volunteers just started to get together. A couple of them asked me if it'd be all right if they contacted other volunteers who might be interested in talking about how unreal, how unexpected, how just bizarre these experiences were with this entity contact. And they really weren't able to talk about it with anyone. They couldn't talk about it with their friends or their spouses, because they just thought that they would be deemed crazy. And so they thought others who had a similar experience would understand it better.
I know there's one fellow who had a feeling that his heart was being eaten by insects, and yet he was having a sexual relationship with them.
Yeah. That was a very, very intense experience for that gentleman. I think also what's a good word? It's an extremely dynamic experience. If you're afraid and you resist, then the entities or the beings or even just the pure emotions or the hallucinations are quite unpleasant, paranoid, persecuting. And if people can let go, the more they let go, the more pleasant the experiences become. And even in the middle of a horrible experience, if the volunteer was able to let go, to surrender to it without resisting, then it turned into a beatific effect.
You know, Rick, I sort of compare what you have done here and the way academia has turned its back on you to the doctors even today, even as we speak, who refuse to prescribe painkillers to terminal patients because they fear that they will become dependent if they give them morphine, which is sort of stupid because who cares if a terminal patient becomes dependent? And it's the same thing here. I think that people are just, they turn away from what you're doing here because, like you, they don't know how to handle it. They don't know what to do with it. I mean, here is double-blind study, which they always say, oh, you know, we believe in paranormal if you could just do it in double-blind studies. Well, you've done double-blind studies here.
Right.
You've done it under the aegis of the FDA. You've done it under, you know, with government money, tax dollars. You did it for 5 long years. And the results are there, and it's all in your book, and yet nothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is some truth in what you're saying.
Thank you.
I'm not sure why this research has been as quietly received as it has. So the book's doing quite well. I'm happy with how the book's done. But the people that are reading the book, at least the ones I hear from, are educated lay people. They're not people from the scientific community. I think two things. One of them is that it is a psychedelic drug and people veer away from that. But I think also the implications are just too alarming in a way. I mean, to really think that this chemical is mediating such unusual experiences that we could study. We could look at near-death experiences. We could look at alien abduction experiences. We could look at mystical experiences by giving people something that their brain produces naturally anyway. It would just unlock too many doors. It would open too. It would just be too much.
Well, that's what I hear all the time about UFOs, you know. The government really knows about the UFOs are there, but they're afraid of telling the people about it because the people will panic. Whole thing is stupid. Either way, either it's true or not true, it's
right.
Still stupid. People are intelligent enough to handle whatever needs to be handled. We did an hour earlier about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
We handled it. You know? The world goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Most people live their daily lives. Has anybody picked up your study and furthered it, or is anybody doing anything more with DMT?
A few years ago, a group began some research with ayahuasca in Barcelona, Spain, the late 90s, early, couple, 3 years ago. And they were interested in the effects of ayahuasca. And they performed some ayahuasca studies. And as a corollary of their ayahuasca studies, they performed a DMT study quite comparable to ours. It was given intravenously, the same kinds of doses.
And did they get the same results?
I don't know. I only have one. Single article from them of the DMT work, and they don't go into much description of the effects of the volunteers. But I think that's common in the scientific literature with any of this psychedelic research. People don't talk about the real subjective effects in the scientific articles. They talk about objective data. They talk about cortisol levels and temperature and things like that. So in terms of what the actual volunteers in Spain experienced, it's unknown at this point, really.
Hmm. Well, Rick, as we come down to the end here, and we'll go to phone calls in the next half hour, we started out talking about why you dropped this research. So what are you doing now? You're a research adjunct to the University of New Mexico. What are you studying?
Well, I am really not doing DMT research. I'm trying to understand what I found with the DMT research. And this may seem a bit strange to you and or your listeners, but I've basically embarked on this very intense study of Jewish texts and commentary to try and understand more of the role of naturally occurring DMT, as strange as that may seem.
Jewish texts, you're talking about like the ancient papers or something?
I'm studying Torah, Prophets, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, all of those sort of classic Old Testament literature and commentaries, Kabbalistic commentaries, spiritual commentaries. And I think I'm starting to get a glimmer of a sense of what the role of what the evolutionary role of DMT may be.
But those are like 2,000 years old in the history. You know, they found an American a couple of days ago. It was reported that they found an American from 13,000 years ago. So you're not going back very far in history.
Well, no, I'm more looking at the ideas, the projections, sort of what we would be like without our physical bodies, as it were, which seems to be maybe what happens with DMT.
Okay, I've only got a minute here, but there's something I meant to get into. Really, you believe, that's why you call it the spirit molecule, you believe that the DMT may well be our soul.
Well, I think it interacts with the soul. I think we experience certain things that are undergone by the soul through the mechanism of DMT. It's a translator almost.
Wow. That's heavy-duty stuff. All right. Rick Strassman has been our guest, or he continues to be our guest. The book, again, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. You have a website, don't you? Quickly.
So the website is rickstrassman.com. That's one word. RICKSTRASSMAN.com.
Okay, so people either buy the book or they can get more information from your website. All right, I hope we've opened some minds tonight, lifted the veil, as it were, whether you're taking DMT or not. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning in a lot of places that we're being heard. Do you know where your ET is? Sitting in for George Nuri, I am Hilly Rose. On the wild card line is Dean from, where are you calling from, Dean?
Baltimore, Maryland, live 105.7.
Very good, sir. Stay. I hope the Ivan doesn't come up the coast there and give you any problems.
Hopefully it won't. Hopefully it won't.
Yeah. You're on the line with Dr. Rick Strassman.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to recant my experience with DMT. First, let me pre-qualify by saying that I'm not a hardcore drug user. I've done some psychedelics. Basically, I just smoke marijuana. And up until the point where I did the DMT, I'd heard about it. I heard it was like an intense LSD trip condensed into about 20 minutes. And basically, I came across it by just being at the right place at the right time. And it was a form of DMT that's found in a toad,
right.
The Bufo alvarius toad.
Uh-huh.
And at the event that I did it in, it was in the mid-90s, I was involved with some people that we threw rave parties, but they weren't rave parties, excuse me, in the sense of where you would go and hear techno music all night long. It was a chill-out event, basically, where you would go and hear ambient music, and it was a very soothing environment. So I think a lot of that had to do with the experience that I had. But when I smoked it, I basically had what you described, a near-death experience. Not that I was afraid that I was dying, but my body was at total peace with everything. My eyes were closed. I laid back when the rush came on. I guess that's how you could describe it. And I felt as if my soul, my entity, not my physical body, but my mind, was transported to another place, another dimension. I don't even know how to describe it to you. And while I was in that state, I saw beings that basically, they seemed as if they were standing over top of me, and at first I sort of thought they were angels. And the longer that I sort of looked at them, they had the large head, black eyes that you would see of a typical gray. And I remember thinking to them telepathically, "You really do exist, don't you?" And they came back to me telepathically with an overwhelming feeling of reassurance and love, as to say, yes, you're correct, we do exist. And with that, I snapped out of it, totally came out of the trance, whatever the whole thing, the experience that I was in, and it was without a doubt the most intense psychedelic experience I've ever had in my life, and I've never come across it again. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
Dean, going into this, did you have any ideas that you might see grays or creatures of another kind?
No, and actually, another, to pre-qualify this a little more, a few months prior to that, I had a close encounter. It was a night that it was, when I saw what I saw, it was between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, ironically. That struck me as a little strange when you said that earlier. And I was completely sober at the time, and I saw what I thought were grays, these little beings that sort of just came through the area that I was in. I wasn't in fear for my life as if, like, I was going to be abducted or anything. It was more of a shock to me to see these creatures staring at me. And, you know, I didn't know what to think about that. I didn't know if it was some sort of hallucination that I had, and, you know...
Well, Rick, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I do, actually. With the question of the dream, I'd like to ask him about, you know, did you think it was a dream that you're having on DMT, or was it qualitatively different than a dream somehow?
Oh, yeah, it was very real. It was very real, unlike a dream. It was, I mean, I was fully aware that I was in, you know, at this rave event, this we called them Cloud Watch parties. I was aware that I was in this place. I was laying down, but, you know, physically, but mentally, I was elsewhere. And again, it wasn't as if, you know, you wake up from a dream and you're like, wow, that was a pretty weird dream. No, this was as real as anything that I've ever experienced, but it was in my mind. And I don't know if that's coming across. You know what I'm saying? Physically, I was laid out in this location where we were throwing this party, but mentally, I was somewhere else.
Okay, my friend, thank you for sharing that with us. Let's go now to the east of the Rockies and talk with Sherry on this line right here. Hi, Sherry.
Hi.
Where are you calling from?
Fort Worth, Texas, KLIF.
Well, welcome.
Well, I'm glad you're back. You sound great.
Thank you very much.
I have a question for the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of out-of-body experiences, and my physician decided he wanted me to try a different antidepressant. And I'm usually on Celexa, and he put me on Lexapro, and he said there was no difference between the two. But yet, when I was taking the Lexapro, I was, you know, I would have that jumpy feeling, but I couldn't relax at night, and I didn't have that peaceful, calm, you know, feeling, especially when you're getting ready to, you know, float out of your body, and you hear, like, the buzzing sound and stuff like that. I couldn't even get to that point. What is the difference between Lexapro and Celexa?
Well, they're pretty similar as far as their pharmacology, but they can have different effects in people. And the point you're raising about sort of a change in, naturally occurring psychedelic experiences, sort of like you're describing as you're falling asleep, sort of leaving your body with that sound in your ears. A lot of people in our study actually described a sound that was associated with their DMT experiences, especially in the very first few seconds of a buzzing or crackling sound, which was quite pronounced. But I think what can happen with psychiatric medications is they do change how the brain functions and its sensitivity to naturally occurring chemicals and those that are taken from the outside. So people on antidepressants sometimes will describe they don't anymore. It's as if the antidepressants preventing the psychedelic drug that they take, like LSD or mushrooms, from exerting its normal effect. So it could be your out-of-body experiences were mediated by the release of excess DMT, and the change in antidepressant is almost blockading that.
West of the Rockies is Bill. Where are you calling from, Bill?
Calling from Tucson, Arizona, KNST.
One of my favorite places.
Oh, that's good.
I love your air museum there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, at the Pima Air Museum.
Terrific.
I wanted to ask you, Rick, what is the origin of the name of DMT? And then I have one more quick question after that.
So DMT stands for its chemical name, and that chemical name is dimethyltryptamine.
Yeah, but I...
That's what I mean is the origin of those words right there.
It's the combination of a group in chemistry, which is called the tryptamine group. It's a benzene ring and a ring that contains a nitrogen. And then there are three, I mean, there are, there are two methyl groups which are attached to the tryptamine. And a methyl group is one carbon and three hydrogens.
Right.
So that's kind of the structure anyway.
Well, you mentioned earlier that one of your original fundings came from the Scottish Rite.
Mm-hmm, that's
right. What
was
the purpose of them funding you? What was their request and their, what were they looking for you to come up with?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So the grant came from the Scottish Rite, but it was a branch of the Scottish Rite that's quite interested in schizophrenia. So the argument I put forth in my grant request was that perhaps elevated levels of DMT are behind naturally occurring psychotic phenomenon, like seeing things and hearing things that other people can't. And so I made the point that perhaps by understanding more about the effects of DMT, we would then understand more about schizophrenia. So that was the approach that the Scottish Rite group funded.
Okay, let's go now to... the first-time caller line and talk with Don. Where are you calling from, Don?
Yes, hi, Ellie. I'm calling from Huntington Beach, California.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Rick, I wanted to set this up and then ask you a question about this. Dr. Rick, I had a near-death experience in 1980 when I was shot through the chest by being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I was flying over the ambulance. I watched these guys cut my clothes off, and I went up to an area to where I actually saw possibly, in my memory, four or five areas of the first, what we consider the astral plane out. And I was shown this by my mother's father. And this first astral plane out is really the creator or creative level. Now, remember a while back you were asking about this research about why these people saw clowns and ETs and all these different things. Sometimes when people have these, and this is just my opinion, but I want to share this with you. Sometimes when people have these experiences, they have both malevolent and benevolent souls on the other side that play games with them. And sometimes they'll be aggressive and show them something nasty, like you were talking about the guy that had the crocodiles in the sexual experience or something like that.
Right, uh-huh.
And sometimes there are clowns and sometimes there are ETs. All those boundaries get crossed in the first creator level of the astral plane out. Now, I was only gone for about 35 seconds. It seemed to me that I was gone for about an hour and a half.
Right.
And when I came back and when I was in intensive care, I was like wigging out and exploding, trying to get somebody to try to understand and talk to this about. And I realized I just had to shut up. So I kept it from the whole family for like almost 4 months, way after I went out of intensive care and got back home to recuperate.
Well, I think these sorts of experiences really do sort of rattle our cages. I mean, they're really difficult to incorporate into our everyday worldview.
Would you actually consider this idea? All alcohol and drugs actually get us to a little bit towards the boundary, and I don't know who brought this subject up or the saying of going past the veil or removing the veil.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, all drugs actually perplex us, the soul that knows that other side, to actually want to be over on that other side, and it tickles the soul, so to speak.
That's actually an interesting concept. I'm going to write that down, actually. I think, though, that there's this dichotomy between the body and the soul, or most of the time that there is, and, you know, the soul wants to cross the veil and the body wants to stay on the side. So it's not surprising there are some malignant and more aggressive sorts of elements, involved in such experiences.
On the wild card line is Camille. Where are you calling from, Camille?
Yes, hi. I'm in Georgia.
Oh, good.
Excellent program, and you're very brave, Rick. I have three parts that I'd like to throw out to you, and I'll hang up gently and listen over the air. It'll be easier to hear. The first part is that I understand with DMT, when they smoke it, that they generally say it's about a five-minute experience, and I'd like you to elaborate more on the difference between smoking it, injecting it, excuse me, and how ayahuasca is taken. I'd like you to talk about, like, for example, the concentrations of the DMT.
Okay, let's get your other two questions in because we're going to run out of time here.
Okay, well, maybe you'll answer them after the break.
We will.
Other part is, if you're familiar with ibogaine, if you would talk something about that, and also if you had been able to have a setting, say with a Sunapatah, without a hospital clinical setting, what you think the results might have been. And the last part of it is I just want to clarify about a lot of Orwellian speak that we talk that has a lot to do with the way the world is and why they say that the age of iron is going to be breaking into a trillion pieces. When you say Jewish literature,
okay,
you're actually...
We'll have to leave you here, and we'll give you the answers on the other side. I'm Hilly Rose, in for George Nuri. Let's go to the west of the Rockies line and talk with John. Hi, John. Where are you calling from?
Hello, sir. I'm calling from San Diego.
Oh, okay. Love. I was there a couple of weeks ago. Saw a great ball game in the wonderful new park that you got down there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
And spent a terrible, by terrible I mean I did awful things in the Gaslight area. Stopped in, had a libation, you know. And, it's really a fun place, San Diego.
It is. It really is.
They've done a wonderful job there.
Yes, yeah. It's really wonderful. I have just a brief story, and there is some relevance here as I see it. My mom, she shared with me a story about 10 years ago. I had bought the book Communion by Whitley Strieber, and one day she saw the book cover, and she says to me, you know, that's the thing I used to see in, like, you know, like the grandfather type clocks, a real tall, wide. Well, she had this clock, this big clock, I guess, in her room corner of the room or whatever. And she would see this, I guess, either at some phase when she either woke up or was kind of in a, you know, waking up state, either go to the bathroom or whatever. But she would see this thing in, like, the clock. She would see it. And it was, like, not just a one-time thing. Every so often she would see it. It was always, like, at night. I haven't picked her brain too much about it. And, it was that. And the interesting thing, or the kind of spooky thing, is that, and I don't know, again, if this is just sheer conjecture, who knows what it could be, but she told me that, she always had this thing in her, like, I don't know, side of her wrist, or in her arm or whatever, and it's like a little ball. It's like a little, she didn't know where it came from or whatever. And so, I'm just making a conjecture that, you know, there is some basis for this. It isn't necessarily just a dream. It's not just a wild imagination, that there's something actually going on here in terms of phenomenon.
But you said she saw it at night, like about 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah, she would see it. She would see it. But my feeling is she didn't see it like, okay, before I'm going to go to bed, I'm going to see this thing. No, she'd see it like when she'd be waking up to go to the bathroom, or like, you know how people wake up, they go back to sleep,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. And I hadn't really picked her brains to ask her kind of like under what circumstances. I mean, she just didn't wake up and all of a sudden see it. I'm assuming it's when she was going to go to the bathroom or whatever, but it was like in the middle of the night. It was like around, like, say, 2 o'clock in the morning, whatever, when
sure.
she was little. And she would see this thing like a big fog, and she'd see it at the clock.
Right. Well, John, do you have a question here?
Well, the other thing is, the question is regarding, is there certain foods that the bioderivatives in relation to this DMT that have more of a concentration or whatever, if you know where I'm going with this?
Yeah, you know, some way to enhance natural formation or something.
Yeah, I'm just curious if there's certain foods that certain people, maybe if somebody eats more. I'm not saying that I'm, you know, wanted to do that. I'm just curious if people eat certain foods, maybe whatever, you somehow create more of it in the body. I don't know. I'm just theorizing.
Yeah. I think it's possible theoretically. And you know, within the last few years, there's a group that's been studying, or not studying, but it's been putting people into extended periods of darkness. These long retreats in darkness, and people start to have a lot of fairly intense visual phenomenon and mystical experiences, in a small number anyway. And these people are proposing that what happens in extended darkness is DMT formation increases. And those people have got a diet which they feed their volunteers or their clients. But I'm not familiar with what's in their diet. It's possible to speculate that the kind of diet they put them on would enhance the formation of natural DMT.
Well, you point out in your book that the DMT appears in lots of plants.
It's very common in plants. It's common in every animal in which it's been studied. So
it could be that the diet might affect you.
It could. It could. It wouldn't make more. It wouldn't. Well, if, for example, there was DMT in the food, it wouldn't necessarily have an effect, but I think the thinking more is that it would increase production of naturally occurring DMT.
Okay. Wildcard line, Marcus, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Boulder, Colorado.
All right, sir.
And I have a question. I've had a couple DMT experiences, the last of which was with a gentleman who had lived with Terrence, I guess, for a bit of time in Hawaii, so I feel really fortunate to have experienced it in such a way that was in a very good setting. And I have to say, I had done it once before with what I'm told is a lesser form, a more visual form, and then there's a stronger form. I was told DMT and 5-MAO, is that correct?
So that is true, actually. And it's a kind of a increasingly common misperception is to equate the other type of DMT, which is called 5-methoxy-DMT.
Would that be the stronger version?
It's about 10 times as strong on a milligram per milligram basis. Other words, 3 milligrams of 5-methoxy-DMT is got an effect that is similar to around 30 milligrams or so of DMT. And the toad slime has high concentrations of 5-methoxy-DMT. So when people smoke the toad, it's the result of 5-methoxy-DMT as opposed to DMT.
On the first-time caller line, Paul. Hi, where are you calling from, Paul?
I'm calling from Texas.
Texas, okay.
Okay, I wanted to say, I've only experienced DMT one time, and it was actually kind of weird. Are you familiar with, like, ketamine and things of that nature?
Uh-huh, yes.
Yeah, I noticed that it had these effects. It kind of gave every shape in the room I could see its own plane, and it would move independent from each other.
Uh-huh.
And I found it very similar to ketamine and DXM and those type of drugs.
Did you close your eyes?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. If you close your eyes, it could get things started in a more interesting way. If you stay kind of fixed on the things in your field of vision, then it can make things a little more static. But if you close your eyes, it could it can help sort of catalyze the experience to the next level.
Okay. Let's go to, where am I here? Joshua, East, I got myself all screwed up here. Let's see. Here we go. Joshua, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi there. Great book, by the way, Rick.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm glad you wrote it.
I just, ironically did ayahuasca last night, for the first time. And I wanted to ask you your personal experiences with it, and well, you obviously made the serpent connection, or you wouldn't be studying the Torah and Kabbalism.
Right.
And if you could just talk about that a little bit, I would be happy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in terms of your first question about personal use, I'm kind of, it isn't a question that I answer with, a large radio audience listening. The question about, the form my study has taken recently with the Jewish texts, I'm quite interested in, views of non-corporeal existence, and I think the Jews have done a good job of describing that.
Okay. Joshua, anything else?
Did you make a serpent connection with ayahuasca?
I'm not sure what you mean.
The snake energy, the serpentine reptilian.
It's a common experience on ayahuasca to see serpents, snakes. Weren't that many reports like that in our volunteers. I actually thought perhaps because of the tight association between ayahuasca and DMT that our volunteers would see serpents and snakes, but they really didn't.
Okay, Joshua. Rick, this whole conversation is not going in the direction I thought it was going to go. It's fine. Whatever people want to talk about is okay with me. But what we seem to be getting are an awful lot of people who have used DMT. I didn't realize it was that widespread.
Well, it's become a lot more popular because of, I think, a number of reasons. Ayahuasca is making inroads into Western advanced, civilization, as it were. It's becoming popular in Western Europe, Eastern Europe. It's popular in the United States and Canada. People want to learn more about what's happening with ayahuasca, and they end up looking more into DMT. And I think that Terence McKenna talked quite articulately and eloquently about some of the effects of DMT, so I think that's raised his profile somewhat.
Yeah, on this program.
And this program. And I've really been gratified by the response to my book. There have been a lot of people been appreciative of the material that's in it.
Well, I guess what I was sort of trying to say here is we've talked about lifting the veil. We've talked about the possibility that there really are ETs. There really is a parallel existence. And we're not getting calls on that particular subject. We're getting calls from people saying, yeah, I dropped the stuff, and I had a similar experience.
Right. It's a pretty interesting drug, and people that were in my study have been changed by being in it, and the people that have been calling in who describe their own DMT experiences, they sound like they made a major impact on them.
Well, obviously it did. I made a statement walking in that I've never taken any kind of psychedelic, and I never plan to. First of all, it's illegal in this country. Secondly, I don't know. I mean, I'm happy. You know, I don't need an additional experience like this. Why would I want to? I mean, I guess what I'm really asking here is for people who just seem to feel that the existence we're in is not enough?
Well, there's a lot of reasons that people take psychedelics in general, in particular with DMT. I think they're looking for an experience. Maybe different, maybe more intense, maybe more emotional and real than they've otherwise been able to experience up until then.
Well, we'll see. We'll take more of your phone calls in the next segment. And I don't know. I you know, words fail me here because I feel this is such important research, and why it has not gotten wider acceptance. And the book, as Rick points out, is sold well, but why the academic community, the research community, has not picked it up and moved further so that we better understand why we are here and what we're all about. Sitting in for George Nouri, I am Hilly Rose.